Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. I'm Lisa Falsko, the CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here on this fine afternoon. If you could please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. This program will be recorded for both KSKA Radio, KACN TV, and today Fox ABC News. Speaking of our listeners at home, I'd like to thank William Toyer and Katie Parrish for doing the recordings. And if you are listening on the rebroadcast and you haven't paid the $25 for lunch, consider donating that to one of those organizations and thanking them for making this possible to the rest of Alaska. If this is your first World Affairs Council, if you could please raise your hand. Oh, a lot of regulars. Fabulous. Thank you for coming. And are there any students? If you could please stand, we'd like to recognize the students present today and to thank BP so much for the sponsorship of all of our students. Welcome. Welcome very much. Thank you for coming, and thank you, BP, for making this possible. If you could take a moment while you're sitting to pick up a survey. We have some surveys now about the program. If you wouldn't mind letting us know what you think, what you want to see, and we will try to listen to all of the comments. I'd like to also thank Ambassador Snyder, who this morning went to Service High School, where he spoke to 100 students. And we are in for a treat that he's coming here for us as well. At the head table, we have to my far left, Mr. Chuck Becker, who is one of our board member emeriti, and Garrett Wong, who will come to the podium to talk about membership and introduce our speakers. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Lisa, and thank you all for being here with us today. Let's talk about membership. You know, the World Affairs Council has invited politicians, academics, business leaders, scientists, a whole host of experts from around the world to share with you, the audience, and to the Anchorage community, a very unique perspective of their views of the world. And our mission, of course, as the Alaska World Affairs Council, is to bring those views to you in a firsthand way. And so after today's presentation, if you're not already a member, we'd like to encourage you to give it some consideration. We've made it real easy. We've got these little cards on the table. And if you just put your name and an email contact address on there, we'll certainly make it easy for you to join us in our efforts to move forward with these programs to make Anchorage a bit more enlightened about the international environment in which we live. So with that, let me take some time and introduce our speaker today. It is my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Ambassador Charles Snyder. He's here today to speak with us on drugs and thugs, the State Department's role in battling narcotics and crime. Now, I've taken the liberty to sort of abbreviate a bit of Ambassador Snyder's extensive resume in an effort to give him maximum time here at the podium, so bear with me. Mr. Snyder is the Deputy Secretary, Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement. Prior to this position, he was the U.S. Senior Representative on Sudan. He has also served as the Acting Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, framing policy towards Central Africa. From 1995 to 2001, he served as Director of the Office of Regional Affairs for the African Bureau. Ambassador Snyder served in the Senior Intelligence Service at the CIA as National Intelligence Officer for Africa from 1992 until April of 1995. He retired from the U.S. Army in 1991 after 22 years of service. Ambassador Snyder served as military advisor on the team which mediated the tripartite agreement between Cuba, Angola, and South Africa, and led the team that established the Joint Military Monitoring Commission, which implemented the ceasefire along the Angola-Namibian border. He received a BA in economics from Fordham University, an MBA in international finance from American University. and conducted additional postgraduate work in international relations at Catholic and Howard Universities. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Ambassador Snyder to the podium.
Now I know why I feel so old and tired. That and the fact I obviously can't hold a job over the years, just switching from one thing to another. But it's really a pleasure to be able to be up here in the wilds of Alaska and away from the craziness that Washington, D.C. is, and perhaps it's even crazier these days. The State Department has grown in many ways over the years, and I think perhaps none so misunderstood or maybe not paid enough attention to, that we've moved so heavily into this area of drugs and thugs, as I like to call it. The State Department got back into the drug business a long time ago in Latin America, and most people, when they think of INL at all, the International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Bureau, think of that kind of work we did in the Western Hemisphere, stopping the narcotics coming out of Colombia and Peru and those kinds of places. But the truth is we've emerged into this more modern and in some ways threatening world post 9/11. One of the gaps that we have overseas, when you look at security sector reform, and of course I'm a retired military man, so I understand the hard part of the security sector, the armed forces, etc. But a big gap was our ability to assist partner nations and developing nations, and the other half was security sector reform, which has got to do with police, the courts, the correction system, etc. Because you have to look at the rule of law area as a whole, and if you just do pieces of it, you're not going to solve anything. And we've moved heavily in that direction. Now, if I can manage to work this, we'll see if I can get the next slide to come up. No, that ain't it. Is it set for the arrows, do you know?
All you do is press page down.
Page down, okay, we'll do the trick. I'm technologically challenged in addition to being senile at this point, so you'll have to bear with me. That and I took a Sudafed, so if I wander off and any or my voice just disappears, that's the reason. This is our mission. I assume if you're a World Affairs Council member, reading is your thing, so I won't go over it, except to emphasize that our goal is really to block the drugs before they get to the United States. That's why the State Department is engaged in this. What your local and state law enforcement people do is stop it when the problem has gotten here. Do what they can. The Border and Customs people in particular try and stop it. Our job is to be overseas trying to catch it before it gets on the ship or it gets on the plane, those kinds of things. And destroy it in the field if it comes to that. One of the things we've been active in over the years is the eradication program in Latin America. That's also carried over into Afghanistan, but that's really what this is about, to reduce the threat before it hits our own shores. And it is an increasing threat, and it's an expensive threat. You can see the kind of profits that are possible when you look at the local news and you see they're now literally building submarines to slide up the west coast of the United States and deliver the narcotics, fully expecting to lose probably half the submarines. They're building them in the jungles of Colombia. And the Colombian government is being very aggressive and very effective going after them. But there's so much money involved in this that the risk is there. So they've even taken to exotic techniques like this, just to underscore what drives all this and why the State Department got engaged. Because our business, of course, is to persuade foreigners to do things that are either in their interest, really, and we're trying to help them, not necessarily perceived in their interest, but again, we can persuade them for things they really don't want to do, but we have ways of seeing them, making them see the light, I guess, is the politest thing to do. And all those things are things we run into in this drug business as I go a little further in. Now, if I haven't lost the ability to change the slide, oh, look at this. These are our objectives. As I mentioned, the criminal justice system is new. It's a new feature in the sense that we started out looking at the drug problem from Latin America, and we've now evolved into this. And I'm an old bureaucrat, as you can tell from my resume. And one of the things that any good bureaucrat realizes over the years is you have to follow the money. And if you look at how we spend the money now, about 45% of it is purely counter-narcotics. The other 55% is really up into this criminal justice systems, rules of law, correction systems, making the cops more effective, etc. Why is that important? One of the things we discovered as we launched forward on the anti-narcotics campaign is in many cases, even when the countries were willing, they lacked the legal structure to do the necessary. The drug penalties were different, they weren't effective, etc. The court systems weren't effective. So if you wind up in a situation where we're turning them into a court system that's not effective, you're in essence practicing catch and release. That happens in other places too. It can happen at the cop on the street level. If he can be persuaded or bribed, etc., catch and release. The evidence can disappear in the system, catch and release. In the correction system, if it winds up being either a clubhouse kind of arrangement, or perhaps the prisoners can go home at night and on the weekends, depending on what country you're in, again, it becomes catch and release, and we had to do something about that. And that meant if we were going to be genuine, we had to get engaged in these areas. And this is not an area that comes naturally to the United States. Again, people ask, why is the State Department in the middle of this? Because if you think about it, we do not have federal police. When I'm talking about the guy on the street, the cop that walks the beat, the cop that drives the squad car, we do not have federal police. We have some of the most effective and best investigative agencies in the world, the FBI for one, the forensic efforts at the international, at our own international narcotics areas, top of the line, everybody wants that. When it comes to drug enforcement, the DEA and ATF and others, top of the line, etc., but they are not police in the classic on the street interacting with the people every day. They're different. And the gap, unfortunately, in many places overseas in these developing countries, literally is at that level. If the first thing that the people see and interact with as a government entity is a policeman and he's corrupt or he's not well trained or he's not well equipped or he's not well educated, that undermines the whole idea of good governance overseas. And if we're going to go after these guys and make them more effective, we've got to work at these building blocks. And that realization came to us maybe a little late in the game, but it's come to us, and we're now moving more heavily into that area. And this is not to say that we aren't using real policemen. One of the big accusations is we've all gotten into the contracting business, and the Congress is rightly honest about how many contractors we use. But the truth is, those contractors are, in many cases, your local policemen. Could be an Alaskan state trooper that is taking a sabbatical, that's got a particular skill that we need and is willing to go overseas for us to a place like Kosovo or Liberia or even the Latin America for us and apply his skill, transfer his skill to that police. So they're contractors, yes, but it's only because of the system we're forced to work in. They're really effective law enforcement officials. And many of them go back to their own service, wherever that might be. Others have put in their 20, 25 years in the police force, and like I could retire from the Army at 22 years, many of them can retire, and they're still relatively young. And we get them coming out of that because they're looking for an adventure. And if we get them to do it once or twice and they really get into it, we've got the most effective people possible, somebody that's interested in the business, has functioned overseas, and is a cop. Can speak cop, if you will. One of the advantages I had all those years of being a military trainer, etc., was there's a profession of military affairs. How you use artillery, how you use tanks, how you control men, how you control fire, how you control the disciplines of death, if you will. There's a system to that, and there's a professional conversation to be had. That exists on the police side as well. And so even though they're accused of being contractors, they really are professionals at what they do. And that can range all the way from the guy I like to talk about most, the guy that hands out the parking tickets, but to the desk sergeant, to the detectives, to the people that run a precinct, to the people that see a city, et cetera. It's a different thing than trying to intercept a particular thing like DEA does or ATF does. They're the best at what they do, but it's not the same as providing a police system and a police entity to a community, particularly a developing community. And it's right there that the drugs, for agricultural reasons in many cases, but also because of lack of strong government, get their root and come in our direction. I always put the slide about the culture of management excellence up there, just in case anybody from Congress is here. We're really all over this. We're managing the money most effectively, and please don't cut me off. I'm too close to my retirement. I'd like to go in good grace. Let me say one thing about transnational crime before I move on. Just like booze in the bad old days in the roaring 20s was a source of a lot of money that went into a lot of other businesses and allowed organized crime to diversify. Drugs is one of the big bucks things. It bleeds into everything else, trafficking in persons, et cetera, et cetera. The same guys that in Africa that would smuggle guns in the old days, maybe cigarettes. Somebody can turn to them, they can run narcotics, they're moving a product. But the money that falls out of that system and the drugs themselves, because many times they're paid in kind, start to destabilize societies because now they're going to move the drugs to get the money. So they're moving the drugs. It's a commodity for them. It's a business. And you've got to remember that. That's what that little point is up there. And this is our success story, which is why you should be paying me a hell of a lot more money. You can see we went from a tiny little thing down here with just a handful of people. That was when we did mostly Latin America. I believe that's $250 million. And we had less than 100 people at that point. And we're now up at 3 billion plus. My guess is the Congress will cut us back a little bit from that. We're up to 388 people that work full-time directly for INL. That's a deceptive number because we have 7,000 people out in the field that are considered contractors. The bulk of them, as you would expect, and the reason that number is driven as high is also the reason you would expect, it's for these bigger programs that are tied to the ongoing wars that are going on. Iraq is at $1 billion for this program alone. And why does it matter that we're in Iraq so much? Because the military has to turn over to somebody. They've trained the army, and because of the numbers involved, they've been doing a lot of the police training using our programs of instruction, our technical expertise, but we don't have the bodies to train a force the size that needed to be trained. So the military was doing a lot of the police training in Iraq quite effectively. They're pulling out, they have to be replaced by somebody, and they can't be replaced by the typical Foreign Service officer. That's not what we do. We can manage the technical experts, but we aren't the technical experts in most cases. And so the number 318 is probably the number we're going to wind up with in Iraq, located in five positions, minus the U.S. military. So the State Department will be going in harm's way in this security sector commitment, along with the rest of the people, the consular affairs officers, etc. Depending on how well we've done in Iraq, we're going to find out how much in harm's way we've gone. But that's one of the reasons that number is being driven high. It's being driven high in Afghanistan as well, because we're starting to take over the police program there. We're a long way from fully taking it over, but we're starting to take it over. And that's under $1 billion at this point. One of the dirty little secrets in Afghanistan is the Taliban, who originally were very hostile, as you may recall from the early days, to the drug traffickers as anti-Islamic, etc., have now discovered that to finance themselves, they need a big cash cow like this. And they've become willing participants in some case, and in some other cases, at least willing to look the other way for the sake of getting this amount of money. And so the drug trafficking problem out of Afghanistan doesn't really come in our direction as much as the stuff that comes out of Latin America, but it's now moving up into Russia and across the East Ands, as I like to call them, those newly independent states that run off there, that runs through Pakistan, and it's become a major drug problem. It's one of the areas where we actually, other than yelling and screaming at each other with the Russians, talk to each other and cooperate effectively. It's in our interest that the Taliban doesn't get the money. It's in their interest that the drugs don't wind up in Moscow, particularly in the hands of the large organized criminal gangs that exist in Moscow and other places along the way. Pakistan is one of those one step forward, two steps back problems for us. We're quite effective in the frontier, which is where we're interested. In fact, we used to advise something called the Frontier Corps. We have helicopters there that belong to the State Department, not to the military. And we've been very good at getting intelligence on what's going on, et cetera. But the relationship in Pakistan, as in any country, turns on the politics, and the politics are up and down. It's not an ineffective program. It was never meant to really stop the drugs in that sense, but to find out what was going on, who was coming and going, et cetera. And it's quite effective in that regard. The West Bank is, again, one of our new programs. When, for a number of reasons, who is going to take the Palestinian security forces, Fatah and the others, and turn them into something that resembles a modern security force, something that other states can believe in as a dependable state entity? For a whole number of reasons, the Defense Department wasn't the right answer. And much like some people call Mikey, I think in this case, INL was called to see what we could do in the security sector. And this is a case where we do everything close up to light infantry training in the sense that we have actual military advisors. supervisors that are doing that kind of training, but the bulk of it is to train them how to be policemen. So if we do get a Palestine at some point, we get a police force and a security sector we can trust. More importantly, between then and now, it is not only the occupying forces, if you will, how the population sees it. It's not only Israeli security, it's now Palestinian security and its effective security. This is a small program, but the politics here, as you can imagine, dicey as hell. It's $150 million now. Maybe we'll still get that money, maybe we won't. But the program itself is quite effective, and my standard for that is the Israeli security services say to us they're happy with what's been done, and they're happy in the areas they've turned over that there's a reasonably competent force there that is actually doing police work, not stimulating the problem. Mexico is the big one. It's right on our border. It's a growth area. You can read the papers as well as I can. You know how bad things are. The Merida Initiative is what the name got attached to it because of where the first agreements were made. It's about a $300 million program, and it's designed to assist the Mexican police forces, the court systems, etc. It's kind of a first layer, if you will, of our own border defense as we struggle with the problem of trying to control that southern border. Some of the estimates of how much drugs move into the United States out of the total allotment are in the 80% range. The good news that's hidden under all that is part of the reason the Mexicans are kind of in this much trouble is we've been quite effective in stopping the flow across the ocean. SOUTHCOM, the military command, the military has been a big player in this, along with the usual suspects, Customs and Border Patrol, etc., in intercepting more and more of the old cigar boats that used to run cigarettes, running drugs, etc., going way up into the small rivers in Florida and Louisiana and elsewhere. We've cut that way back, but there's so much money to be made, it's now moved on land. And that the Mexicans are now fighting it, the problem is pressing down into the smaller states, Guatemala, Costa Rica, etc. But one of the reasons is we've been effective. The reason they're doing the end run and doing innovative techniques like the submarines is they've got a problem keeping that delivery up. And so they're moving to more and more innovative techniques. And the key to this is, in the end, the Mexicans, us, holding together and stabilizing the situation. But it's a dicey business, and you can read that for yourself in the newspapers. Colombia is the big success story, and Colombia is kind of the lamp into our feet. Americans don't like 10-year, 12-year, 15-year programs. But in this case, that's what it takes. You're talking about making fundamental changes in a society, making fundamental changes in their security forces, in some cases making fundamental changes in their law. Why did it work in Colombia? It worked in Colombia because the Colombian people in the Colombian political class were committed against a revolutionary group originally, the FARC, Forces Armed Revolutionary Colombia, that has now turned into nothing much more than a drug cartel. They're still in the field, but they're very heavily dependent on the drug production. And their political program that was never well sophisticated is even less. And so they're coming out for what they really are, kind of a drug enforcement agency. They're still very active. But we've had the kind of success now where not that long ago, we actually got three Americans back in a combined raid that the Colombians led that had been kidnapped years earlier. So things are changing, and that's a success story. The Colombians are now going out in the neighborhood and training people too. So the burden is not on us alone anymore. The Colombians in some cases are out doing it. The Colombians are now beginning to cooperate with the Africans where the problem has now sprung up. And it's much better, frankly, from somebody who's more recently been there in terms of development to try and see what that country needs, because he knows or she knows what worked in my country, and I'm not that farther up. Now, I'm pushing into the top development sector, but I just got there. I remember what it was like. And it's much easier to transfer those skills if you got that in the back of your head. But that's the whole game here. And the Colombians are doing their part. Central America and the Caribbean is a new program, again, because it started to spill over again. We're back to some of the countries we were in earlier, working more hard because some of the drugs are spilling back in that direction again, Jamaica, etc. Relatively small numbers. And I put the aviation piece up there because I like to think we have the second largest Air Force in the United States government. We used to have the second largest government in the United States Air Force. We turned about 100 helicopters over to our partners over the years. We still have better than 200 airframes, then auto helicopters, some CASA, some small planes. A lot of it to do with the eradication, but of a lot of it to move things, move supplies, move people in places where the environment's threatening. Hopefully, in the end, when we're done, our aviation section will be mostly transferred to other people. But for now, we're one of the bigger air forces, and it takes a good chunk of our money to keep these things in the air. And a lot of people, when you say the State Department, don't think of the Air Force. We're literally located on Patrick Air Force Base in Florida, and we've got a good chunk of the field over there. And White Patrick Air Force Base, some of the special forces types are down there, and our guys that fly these things are, in almost every case, retired special operators of some kind, or crazy bush pilots. So if there's some Alaskans here that are interested in it, it could work. The new initiatives of Central Asia, Central America, and West Africa. Why Central Asia? As the Afghanistan drug problem swirls, it's starting to flow again. And as the more disciplined, hardened, and brutal Soviet Union system has been replaced by weaker states that have emerged, the Eastans, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, the drugs are finding a better way to flow up to where the problem is now, hitting the Russians, the Ukrainians, and others. And it's a place where we've actively agreed to cooperate with them. It's a place also where our military force is engaged in being supportive, just like SOUTHCOM is supportive of our efforts. CENTCOM has been supportive of our efforts up in this area, which they're responsible for. Again, the security sector is there, but it's not responsible in the same way where they're flying aircraft. It's more where they're talking to their counterparts and saying, you've got to help with this, because they can move faster than your police can. You've got to help, et cetera. So it's a development, but you're not talking a lot of money. We're talking in the $20, $25 million range here. One last point before I get off it, and I told it to the high school kids this morning. The Central Asia problem, the Russia problem, is actually devastating because of the entrepreneurial activities that are now beginning to take place. It's not just that we're getting cocaine now anymore, we're getting enhanced, improved cocaine. There's a new drug moving up into Russia. It hasn't seeped, thank God, in our direction yet. It's called Crocodile, for crocodile. It's a very potent cocaine-based narcotic. Why is it called crocodile? The injection site, it tends to cause scaly skin. And if you use it often enough, it actually begins to turn that area green, wherever the injection site is. And so the Russians that used it have named it crocodile. After it's injected, as few as two, almost always at three times, you're addicted to it. The dirty little secret that we and the Russians are trying to put out into the broader population is we do not know of anyone that has become addicted, that has survived beyond 3 years. This stuff is killing them, but it's the best, apparently, the best high they can get. And so we're dealing with insidious innovations now beginning to flow up here, and particularly in this area. So this is an important, although a small program, because we need to nip this kind of stuff in the bud. Central America, again, you know, you've got to do something about the Mexican problem. You've got to treat it holistically. We're moving in a small program effectively in there, in Guatemala and some other places. West Africa is new for us, and it's somewhat new for the cocaine cowboys. I guess the good news, if you're European, is the euro is very strong. Well, if you're a cocaine businessman is used to doing business in dollars, you know. When the Yankee dollar goes down and the euro goes up and there's demand over there, the price relationship, and whether I move that stuff to the United States, or what the hell, maybe I can actually move that into Europe. Because the heroin, which is really more what flows out of the opiates that flow out of Afghanistan, that's old hat in Europe and some of these crazy circles. The cocaine's a new thing, and now there's money there. The euro's more valuable. And so they're beginning to move up in that area. And how do you get the drugs from Colombia and other places? If you go straight in, these are pretty sophisticated countries in Europe. Their border patrols and stuff are pretty good. So you got to mix and match. Why not have Africa as a big transition point? We can get the swallowers, the guys that literally swallow balloons. You can get the breaking down of the small, put it in dolls, put it in that kind of stuff, mix and match. Put it in different ships, put it in tramp steamers. Try and move it up through the other parts of Africa and literally put it on some of the ferries to take the agricultural products across into Italy and the rest of these places. So it's moved into West Africa, and the West African governments themselves are so weak that with the amount of money flowing in, at least in a couple of cases, they become narco states. Effectively, the narcotics traffickers can do what they want, and we're beginning to push back in there. It's small dollars, but it's a crucial program. And the proof of the pudding, if you will, is my boss, the Assistant Secretary for INL, took a group from a symposium in Europe that we sponsored with the Europeans on this problem. And then we took an entire team of American law enforcement officials, very senior people, the equivalent of assistant secretaries, senior law enforcement officials from DEA, FBI, Justice Department. In fact, his counterpart in the Justice Department, Lanny Brewer, went with him. Literally, we put 12 very senior American law enforcement officials on a plane and flew them down to Ghana and Liberia to show them the problem, but much more importantly, to show to the Africans that we understood it was a problem and to say that this just isn't the State Department. These are real, genuine, high-ranking American police that are interested in this, interested in helping you, etc. So we put a big push on this to try and stabilize things. I'll tell you one story here. I've been in the African business for years, as you can see from my resume. A Canadian I know that is really a good-hearted soul and has been working for years in Guinea-Bissau doing educational, other kinds of work, big donor. He's got his own business. I think he's in the stock and commodities business. Anyway, he's got millions that he spends for charitable purposes in Guinea-Bissau in particular. And his reward has always been he goes out fishing. Great, great fishing out there. And every year he's always done the same thing. I had lunch with him not long ago, and I said, you know, how did it go? And he said, you know, you guys have a much bigger problem, like I've been trying to tell you, than you think. We were out fishing. We were having no luck in the usual spot. And so I said to the captain, who he's known for years, you know, why don't we go over there? And he goes, oh, we can't go there, boss. So he says to him, why not? He says, well, that's not Guinea anymore. So he says, what do you mean it's not Guinea anymore? He says, that's Colombia. The cartels had literally taken over the islands to the point where the fishermen wouldn't go. And we're afraid. And these are pretty hardy souls if you're not fishermen. Nobody pushes them off their fishing ground. But they'd done pretty aggressive things to do that. So the problem is real. It's not aimed at us. These drugs are moving mostly up to Europe. We do get some backflow because the Nigerians are active and sometimes the South African drugs flow. Not the South Africans per se. Any African that's going to get into this business, you need to be where the aviation hubs are. And the two big ones right now happen to be there and Lagos. So some of it flows back our way, but the bulk of it's going to Europe. But it's a case where we're trying to partner with people. This doesn't need to be our burden alone, and the Europeans are engaging in a big way. So are the Africans, but the base is so low, and the courts and other things, that it's an uphill fight now. But if we don't have this fight now, we are going to face the kind of overwhelming tide that we wound up facing in Colombia and Peru and other places. I want to be sure I leave you time for questions. The next 5 years, okay. I'm a military guy. I can't do 10-year plans because that's communist. But I can think out 5 years. And if I think out only 1 year, that's tactics. And once you get to be a colonel, you don't do tactics. So we need to kind of think in this term. You can see that from our point of view, that we think they've hit the high water on the military side, and we need to do the end game. And that's the State Department role in that security sector. Yes, the military assistance pieces will stay, but that's a post-wartime thing, and we need to ramp up in a way we haven't really done before. We're going to do more on the home front. It's obvious. Mexico, you can read the papers. The Caribbean, it's coming back at us in all directions. SOUTHCOM is still engaged and been quite effective in this, and we'll have to make sure that they stay with us all along. This is now becoming a vast criminal enterprise. It's not just counter-narcotics. The counter-terrorist piece is involved. They're funding themselves this way. And the counter-intelligence piece is involved in this, too. Sometimes they're getting information on American targets and other kinds of things from these same people. It's all one big package. So this is going to take a whole-of-government approach. And when I stop arguing and fighting with the Justice Department, you know we're serious. And some of my best friends are now in the Justice Department because this is an area where the bureaucracies rub against each other. You know, what is the State Department doing this? Well, the Justice Department overseas is not to do foreign assistance. So we're now cooperating a lot better. Homeland Security is with us now, working overseas with us. DOD was always there from the beginning because of the technical skills they have. Treasury, when it comes to money laundering, has always been there. But a lot of the operations need to be paid for, as they should be paid for, out of the foreign assistance budget. If this operation is going to be run in a foreign country, even though we're the beneficiary, it's a lot easier if the money's in the State Department's hands, and it's a lot clearer, and we have to keep persuading Congress of that. We fund a lot of the drug busts that DEA does overseas, supporting their colleagues. But it's better to stop it over there. than it is to try and stop it here. And so we'll fund a lot of that kind of stuff. But so the reason those numbers are so high, a lot of this is flowing into our law enforcement. And we do have U.S. law enforcement entities overseas. There are a lot of Justice Department lawyers in various places, a lot of FBI liaison in various places. There's now Homeland Security liaison in a lot of places. So we're all present on the map. But the money needs to kind of stay in the foreign assistance column, so we're doing the accounting right. And the Congress, I think, is beginning to buy into this. Think regionally, build more partnerships. It's obvious that we can't pay for all this. And it's not all aimed at us. And we've got to do a better job in mobilizing them. The Europeans are now really coming along. And for those of you that are steeped in history, I'll give you one example of what's different now. The Europeans have begun to hit pretty hard some of these drugs that are coming up out of Africa on ships and other things. And those of you that remember the Armada can imagine, even to this day, the level of fondness between the Spanish and the British navies. And yet, I actually saw one of the biggest drug busts that went down off the coast, in which a British patrol ship that had Spanish law enforcement officials on it, because don't forget, this is police work. Somebody has to have arrest powers or you're screwed when you take people to an American or a European court. But it was a British ship with a Spanish constable on board, and the picture of the Brits getting in the rubber boats to go grab this thing, wearing Spanish flags on their sleeves, must have had Queen Elizabeth rolling over in her grave. Elizabeth I rolling over in her grave, and the fact that they were then transported and effectively prosecuted in Spain. So the Europeans are serious about this, and we have expertise to bring, and so do they, with different kinds of drugs. And again, more law enforcement agency players. I had to have one acronym that didn't make any sense, LEA. More law enforcement agency players overseas is part of it. You need to put the experts out there, and they need to be part of our embassy team. And I think I've left you the 20 minutes I promised for questions. And if I haven't, tough. But, and I'll take questions on anything you're interested in. Sure.
Thank you. Got a lot of different questions, but I guess you're talking. I guess I'm kind of wondering what the production of drugs is from these different areas and the agricultural aspect. You were talking about cocaine coming from Asia, Central Asia. Does that mean that they're growing coca plants in Central Asia? Is there a change in the agricultural production?
The stuff from Central Asia are the opiates. The coca comes from where you would always expect. So if I misled you on that, that's not the case. It's the opiates. But the opiates are making a bit of a revival. Heroin, et cetera, is coming back. And the production is now very dependent on the governors in different Afghan provinces. We're having a great deal of success. If you've been following the nightly news, you know the Marines and others in Kandahar were doing a good job. The governor was being effective. The drugs are being cut down there. But it's a very mixed picture, and a lot of it depends on the weather. And so the opiates are coming back despite our spraying and eradication efforts. We've had better luck on the eradication and spraying efforts in Colombia in particular, but you got total government commitment. But even there, there are places like Peru and Bolivia where you can grow the coca, and there's an upswell in that kind of production. There's an unclad, those of you that are interested in this, you know, we put out the country puts out a national drug strategy, and a lot of the statistics are available online if you go to the drug enforcement web pages, and they've got the most recent production statistics in it. And much more importantly, they'll also tell you where they think the drugs are reaching the United States and what percentages. And I'd be misleading you if you think I have those numbers at my fingertips. But the problem is those two major sources. The amphetamines and others are a problem for us as well, but that can be produced in the United States fairly readily. So the inflow from the overseas is not that great, except when you get into some of the exotic stuff. And one of the things we're going after there are the precursor chemicals. Cocaine may be our top target, but the precursor chemicals, which have many industrial uses, when you start to see them being moved in numbers that don't make any sense from countries that are, it's almost like arms control. You know that I'll pick a republic, the Republic of who the hell are you, Istan, has shipped 20,000 rifles when their total national need for rifles is 5,000. There's something odd there. And when East Bajulistan suddenly starts shipping 5 metric tons of some of these precursor chemicals from this small refinery they've got that has already done the national production for the next 10 years, you have to wonder why. And if you can get those chemicals, and we're doing a better job with these, the treaty part of it, where the State Department really is engaged, and with the UN Organization Against Drugs in Vienna, to stop blocking that by putting laws into place to stop that. So the domestic market, which is new, and if we're ever going to have a crocodile kind of problem, my guess is it'll be a boutique drug that comes out of these kind of labs that are cooking meth in the United States. They do ship some in from overseas, but it's not particularly usable. The problem that the overseas countries have, they literally, in some cases, the Laotians, for instance, who hit a big meth lab in the middle of nowhere, clearly the meth was being run not for the Laotian population, but was being run for the tourists in Thailand. Very convenient economically, pretty porous borders. They literally didn't have the money to blow the place up effectively, other than pollute everything within 3,000 miles. And we found a way to supply them together with one of our allies, enough money to blow the big factory up they'd found up and contain it so it didn't wind up in the Mekong River and we didn't have fish with three heads and all other kinds of things. But that's another one of these basic underlying problems. That's not quite the answer to your question, but I'm willing to take another one from you.
Thank you very much for talking to us. It's actually somewhat rare that we get someone with your particular background in terms of Africa, and so I'm glad you've been willing to throw the ball open in terms of questions. Forgive me if this is a bit open-ended, but what is it, in your opinion, would be the most important thing that we need to know about Africa but don't?
That it's not the tragedy you see in the papers. Every time you see African news in the United States, it's some disaster. It's mass rapes in the Congo, it's mass killings here, it's the Somali mess, it's the pirates. And underneath that, there's a second piece of Africa where there's success and movement, where there's real progress. It's not as much as it should be. It's not as much as we'd like to be. It's not the story that's drowning it out, but it's there. Places in West Africa, Liberia, for instance, for those of you that follow Charles Taylor and General Buck Naked and the whole Liberian morass that went on, has now been replaced by a very effective government, Ellen Sirleaf Johnson, and is beginning to turn that around. And we're in there engaged with the police program. We're in there rebuilding the army. But I'll tell you one story where you can make a difference with this kind of engagement across the board in Africa. Her son was the interior minister. Actually well-educated, etc., but, you know, rumors are rumors, and he was her son. He approached us several years back and said that he'd been approached by the cowboys, and they wanted to move a lot of drugs through the wall. He actually ran an operation for us for over 2 years and took the political heat, and his mother took the political heat because she understood how important this was. They were all over Africa. It was, oh, Sirleaf Johnson's son, oh, he must be rich. He's making big money. One of the biggest drug busts we made rolled up a huge operation, et cetera. The Liberians arrested and prosecuted that end of it. But he literally stuck with us for 2 years when he was taking all kinds of rumors. But we're getting to that kind of success story. That didn't get a lot of print. It's not as glamorous as when, you know, Nicolas Cage basically plays Victor Butt and trades guns all over Africa. That's the story you see in too many cases. On the other hand, I don't want to give you the wrong impression. Basic governance and basic development is an ongoing issue. Somalia is, everybody calls it an ungoverned space. It's governed in a different way, but we can get it back into the international system, but it's not going to be tomorrow. It's what we have to think out a decade. You know, I'm going to put this one little piece on the ground, and if the next guy puts another piece on the ground, then the Europeans put a piece on the ground, and the Somali people finally start to put some pieces on the ground, and some of the Arab money that's now not helping starts to help, we can change things there. So I'd argue, I don't know if it's a half full glass, but it sure ain't bottomlessly empty, which is what the press sometimes gives you the impression of. Sure. If he can give you the microphone. Yeah.
Thank you. It seems like the drug lords are just getting bigger and bigger from the profits. What do you think would be the effect of legalizing drugs?
Fortunately for me, that's not a State Department problem, but my personal opinion on this is that it wouldn't help. We have to look at some of the things the Europeans have done in mitigating the problem. Total prohibition may not be the best answer either. There may be a happy ground somewhere in between, but I'm not an expert on that piece of it. You really need to ask the domestic drug czar, et cetera. I'm just committed to fighting this other piece of it. And I think we've actually made some progress when you look at what's coming into the United States, so it's not hopeless from that point of view. But the demand side, like a lot of our allies press for, is something we need to do more about. And that's domestic politics. In this case, I'll say thank God, because I really wouldn't know where to begin if I had that particular problem. But I think various governors have stepped up to the plate, and our piece of it is to try and minimize the problem that they have to address. There are mixed views on it.
You mentioned Colombia as being a success story, and I would agree with that. My mom is from Colombia, and I was just there in January. And the difference between, you know, in the mid-80s when my uncle, who's a geologist, got kidnapped in the jungle by the FARC, and now when I go to Colombia and I've never felt unsafe, being wherever I was, in Cartagena or Bogota, wherever it is, how do you change the perception of most Americans? Because I still get questions, aren't you afraid to go to Colombia? Aren't there just, like, you know, guerrillas everywhere? And while I was there, there were many, many European tourists, but not so many Americans. How do you change that perception of Colombia as being a really dangerous country full of drug cartels, and that's all that's going on?
Well, I think you do things like we're doing here, and like the Latin American Bureau does. When they get out on the hustings and they're talking to people, they put it out there. And if you look at the travel warnings, which, you know, anybody that's going overseas and doesn't know the area really needs to look at the travel warnings and the background papers the State Department puts out. The language on Colombia has evolved so much in a favorable direction that it's amazing, actually, considering where they started and how much further, you know, we're encouraging people to go if they want. You know, there's Cartagena and there's all kinds of places to see. But it's one of those things that it'll take a decade to change, just like it took a decade to change the facts. It's going to take a decade, I think, to change the impressions, because those impressions, amazingly, are well held. A counterpart example could be, you know, the American tourism in Mexico is still there. But if you look at the violence, you'd be going, oh, wait a minute. But the truth is, it stayed away from those areas. And Colombia, the same way, you need to start pointing out that they're open for business in various resorts, it's fine, et cetera, and make that point. So it's possible. And again, Colombia, on the other hand, isn't next door. You know, I can't get my car and drive down to it. So the tourist you're going after is a little more upscale and maybe more reachable. But like I said, even though what I'm saying here is kind of pushing along in that direction. So I think it'll change, but not quickly. It's just perceptions, you know. I still remember the Pan Am stewardesses fondly, and now they're bringing them back as an antique TV show. So you can see how long it takes me to change my impressions.
Thank you for presentation. It was very interesting. My question is about internal situation in the United States. And the question is, what part of the United States does have the biggest problem with the smuggling of illegal drugs?
Yeah, that's not in my area. I literally don't know the answer to that. But if you went to that web page, there's an entire, I think the thing is about 80 pages, the National Drug Strategy. It has that kind of statistics in it. I just don't know. I mean, I could look it up for you, but I don't know.
I wanted to ask you if you could give us a brief tutorial about the Sudan. I know that that's not what you're working on right now, but I dare say you know a great deal about it. And I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about bilateral relations between the U.S. and both parts of the Sudan, the South Sudan, but also the Sudan, now slightly shrunken, which I know was one of the countries President Bush put on the axis of evil a long time ago.
Well, Of course, you all know the Isaiah quote about that cursed land down under Egypt. So if, when you start from that base, you've got a real problem. But Sudan is an extremely complex problem, the problem from hell in many ways. And when I was engaged in the very beginning, we had the situation where the military coup had come to power, led by Bashir, and replaced a legitimately elected government led by one of the older families, the Ansar sect, and somebody named the Mahdi. For those of you that are fancier of old movies like Khartoum, the Mahdi's people are the ones that take Charlton Heston's head off on the stairs going up to the palace at the end of the movie. But we went out and checked, because we'd gotten indications again that maybe there was a possibility of making a deal with them. They were a military government, and we discovered they were something else. This is back in 98. But the opportunity was there because of American interest there. American missionary societies, development people, World Vision, Catholic Relief Services, you picked them. They were all very active in helping the Southern Sudanese who were being, had been under pressure for over 20 years in a civil war, pretty much Arab versus African, if you will, pretty much Islam versus Christian and animist, although that's not entirely accurate, but for broad sweeping generalizations and just bloody awful stuff. Congressman Frist, Senator Frist, when he was majority leader before that, as a heart surgeon, is now operated down in southern Sudan, literally out in the bush, and several times the damn near been bombed. So you had a big American political engagement there. You had the Black Caucus, who was also on your side. So you had the beginnings of a real coalition, which gave us the possibility, we thought, for changing things at the beginning of the Bush administration. And so we engaged in a conversation with several of the key people that went something along the lines of, and this is before 9/11, not a whole lot before, before 9/11, maybe May before 9/11, and basically said, the lady or the tiger. We're the world's big superpower, in case you haven't paid attention. What you're doing down here is unspeakable. You don't think we've got a motivated political class? Which part? And they're well-educated. I mean, most of them, hell, half of them went to school in Canada, the United States. You don't think we can do something about this? Try us. The Democratic Black Caucus is on it, blah, blah. Or you can have the lady. We'll open a negotiation with you, in which, as long as you understand, we're not going to be fair, because we think the Southerners are the aggrieved party, but we'll be reasonable. Let's see where we can go. And that was really the beginnings of it. And that idea really still hasn't changed. It's the idea of, where can you get Khartoum to go without self-destructing at this point? Because the judgment, at least when I last left this, and I don't do Sudan anymore, was self-destruction might be worse. And so we needed to push them down the road. The Southerners, as you know, as a result of that long struggle, along with Jack Danforth, who did a big deal of getting that first 2005 agreement pushed through, Senator Danforth, had to do with basic changes in the system. And the truth is, I really do believe John Garang, as you know, died in a plane crash shortly after, helicopter crash shortly after that. I really believe that Garang didn't necessarily see the end game that played out this way. I think there was a chance that you could have used the South as a lever to transform everything. That chance went pretty much with Garang, and we've never been able to get it back. Where are we now? The Sudanese are heavily engaged in very destabilizing activities in several places, the Blue Nile, etc. We're back to where we have to make those kinds of suggestions again, and in impolite references to, you know, enough is enough, and the Africans are acting. The Africans are on board this time. The UN is on board this time. They put a force into Abyei, which is this small city in dispute. So the circumstances are different. But it's an extremely difficult problem in many ways, because with the southern piece gone, the accusation can now be, well, we're interfering in Arab affairs, blah, 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 you know, which is what you're always doing, and it plays differently. I'm optimistic that we can stabilize the southern piece of it, but it's going to be basic development. And I'm not so sure we fully grasp that yet. But basic development that can be helped a lot by outside actors, by people like World Vision, etc. For instance, one of the things that sparks the violence is this so-called cattle raiding. But the cattle raiding happens because they're moving the cattle, one ethnic group and another, because of water problems. Now, the solution, we all know what it was to drill more boreholes, et cetera, and to get the water supply there so the cattle don't have to be moved. Well, it wasn't particularly competently executed. The government wasn't particularly competent on these matters. Who knows where it went? Some of the money's probably in Jersey. Who knows? But it wasn't done very well. It needs to be done more effectively this time. And then it needs to be followed up with other things to begin to stop that kind of movement. The young men have no employment. There's no basic employment. But there's no basic education, and there's no medical system either. Some kind of basic corpsman training for a lot of people, basic education training to begin to make them part of the solution, not part of the problem. And then you've got to reach out to the women, because if you're ever going to get development really going in Africa, you've got to do a better job. Of bringing the women into the debate politically, but certainly into the development efforts. And one of the things you could do, they've already asked many of the NGOs, they want sewing machines, microfinance, etc. If you give mom a reason to say, I'm not hauling this 50-pound sewing machine, because I'm making more money than you are, pal, on the cattle, by the way, 250 miles following the water, you start to settle the population, and you begin to build a different kind of economy. Because if you don't unplug the cause, you're going to be putting the fire out constantly in these flashpoints as they fight with each other. It's also the whole, you have to change the culture. Success has to be defined for the male in a different way than stole 5 cattle and killed 3 guys on the other side. You have to define success differently. But there needs to be a change, including access more to the outside on roads to move product. This is a decade, 2 decades long of well-aimed, well-focused efforts. And I don't know if we got that before we have a lot more violence, but that's where it has to go. And I think that's where we're trying to go and where the World Bank and others are trying to go. The question is, do we have the time? Long answer, but it's a pet rock of mine. So.
Time for one more question.
You can pick.
Okay. I'm going to mix my question in with a comment. I lived and worked in New York City for 30 years, and on any given day, the estimate was that because of the commuters coming in from the tri-state area, there'd be 9 million people working in Manhattan. Well, it's incredibly easy for anyone in New York City to get drugs. The drug sellers work the parks, and people would go out and take breaks in the parks. And there's many public parks in Manhattan. And everybody thinks of Central Park, but that's just the biggest one. I'll give you one example of when I walked out of the New York Public Library into Bryant Park at 52nd and 5th Avenue. A person who looked like an accountant, a regular office worker, approached me and asked me if I wanted to, try some drugs. And I started looking into this more. And I found out from talking to friends of mine and observing that these drug sellers would look like typical office workers, the way they dressed and their mannerisms, and they would target the people in New York City, not foreigners, not visitors, because they wanted regular customers. And there was no shortage of drugs in New York City at all. And many of these people who had excellent educations and high-level jobs, a lot of them decided, okay, they'd try some of these drugs, and they couldn't handle it. And eventually, it took a few years, but their lives were ruined. Okay, I'll make a question out of this now. I was kind of shocked that there were no undercover cops in these parks, that you are not even aware of the massive amount of drugs that are being sold and used in New York City. So that's my comment. Do you want to comment on that then?
Well, I don't do a domestic thing, but one of my cousins was a New York City police captain, and he'd probably agree with it. It's the problem from hell. But he'd also tell you there were probably undercover detectives there, etc. But I'll put one point. I told you earlier that we engaged the state and local entities, etc. And to show you how engaged in getting to the root of these problems, well, the city of New York is, which is a good example in this case. The city of New York actually has a good number of Haitian American cops. And when we had the big problem there post the earthquake in Haiti, etc., we needed people that could speak some Creole, were real cops, etc. And New York City, after we asked politely, basically agreed to spare some of these guys in a cycle that we could live with, to literally get out there and basically get the Haitian police force back up on its face. Now, why did they do that? They did that for a couple of reasons. One, a lot of the drugs you're talking about, not a lot, but a chunk. If you have to put all the pieces together, because New York is so ethnic, a chunk of it is moving out of the Caribbean down the Haitian lines. They're trying to fix the problem on this end in the Haitian-American community with their policing, etc. Better to go down and get a ground check on what's going on down on that end with the actual cops down there at SEED, etc. And they learned, they made relationships and professional kind of relationships that help get the information. Something that maybe somebody else has paid somebody else not to tell you. Suddenly my friend in New York gets a phone call and, you know, this is coming, you know. Well, for old times, I owe you this. So they're doing a lot of things that you don't see, and they're doing some things that on the surface, a lot of people would say, you know, what the hell are we wasting New York policemen in Haiti for? What, has the mayor lost his mind, or has the commissioner lost his mind? No, there's a valid reason for them from being down there doing that, and they're aimed at this particular problem. The gangs in the United States, you know, MS-13 and these others, we do this corrections training, and one of the reasons the state, various states, Colorado for one, but some up in Minneapolis and elsewhere, state of Minnesota, have agreed to partner with us, is when they go down and work in these prisons down in the heartland where this problem is coming from, they make different kinds of contacts. And some of the gang signs that they then see marked up in the cities that they come from, they didn't know what the hell they meant. The guy in the prison down there damn well knows. So they get a lot of police intelligence. So that even though they're doing us a foreign service good, the real motivation for these state and local cops to do this for us, when you put aside the adventure and some element of that, is because they're getting the kind of information and the kind of ground truth that they can't get except through a very different filter when you're doing it on the ground in Minneapolis and so on. So I don't know the answer to you. Again, that's a domestic problem, and one of the reasons I'm in the State Department and my cousin went into the New York police system is he wanted to try and do something about that, and I wanted to go overseas and have adventures. We both wound up doing the drugs, but with very different perspectives. And the other thing is, we don't have to get them all. The idea is the tipping point. You see, the drugs are going elsewhere. Every time they have to ship the drugs elsewhere, they're exposing themselves as well. So the tipping point may be 40%. If we were able to stop 40% of the drugs from getting in the United States, we'd make it so much more profitable. 50% of the production is going to start going overseas, and we're going to get more and more of that. At the end of the day, we're going to have a big-time domestic decision on this or reevaluate what we're doing. In the meantime, this is the best we're going to do. And a lot of it depends on this overseas piece being played out correctly. And it's not just, the MS-13 is not just drug movers. I mean, they're gangs for gangs. And so some of the police intelligence, as I pointed out, we're getting way over into law enforcement because it also helps us domestically. Because there are large populations from overseas. This is a country of ethnicities. And sometimes to go back and see what's new, because people send money home. They have connections home, and you see it come back here. And you need to have a cop's eye. You need to have the cop on the beat's eye to see some of the things that, like, you know, me with my suit and my white wine, I'm going to go right by that and go, isn't that terrible? And he's going to go, oh, you know what that means? I saw that once before. That means he did this and he used that, and I wouldn't be able to read any of that. And we get all that. Not the answer to your question, but I don't do domestic stuff, thank God. But thanks for your attention.
I want to thank Ambassador Snyder for both coming to Alaska to speak for us here at the World Affairs Council and for Service High School. And we have a book of Alaska to try to entice you to come back.
Thank you. I keep this away from my wife. I'll be safe for a while. But I know she gets this, and you know, the eagles and the sea otters and the glaciers. I'll be back.
Thank you. Thank you. Our next program will be on October 7th. We'll be back upstairs in the chart room. We're expecting a sold-out crowd, so please send in your RSVPs. We will be featuring Billy Shore from Share Our Strength. You might have seen Jeff Bridges, who promotes this program, No Kid Left Hungry. And he will be discussing the imaginations of unreasonable men and women in creating community change. Please send in your RSVP. Thank you.
Relax a little bit. Now we are on sort of the census.